Animal Gab Radio. We've got talk with a tail. Welcome to Animal Gab Radio. I'm Aza Cody, artist, animal advocate, pet chef. This talk with a tail is Oceana, the amazing animals that live in the sea, part one, featuring an in-depth interview with educator Nate Sandel from the Columbia River Maritime Museum. I would like to welcome my guest, Nate Sandel. And why don't you tell me about yourself?
Sure. I'm the education director at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. So I'm in charge of all of our on-site field trip programs. I also manage our museum in the schools program and do all of our adult education programs and volunteers as well.
Just give us a sort of a quick rundown of the kind of animals that live within our area in the lower Columbia and the northern coast.
Sure. And I'm going to kind of focus on marine mammals because that's sort of where my knowledge base is and also where my love is. So basically, everybody in Astoria knows we have California sea lions. And those are the sea lions that you hear barking down at the East End Mooring Basin. If you've ever been to Bowie Beer, those are the California sea lions hanging out under the dock. And when you look out in the river and you see a little blackish or brownish head popping up, those are the California sea lions. And in the Columbia River, we only have males. There are no females that live here.
Why?
The females all stay down in California. And if you've ever noticed, there's a period of time in the summer where it all goes quiet in Astoria. And you don't hear that, you know, familiar barking sound. All those males head down to California in June, and they're looking for mates. And the ones who don't find a mate, which, you know, is a fair number because you have to realize that sea lions, they have a harem. So if you are a younger sea lion, you have not been able to push your way in and steal another adult male's harem. So the ones who don't find mates, usually the overweight ones, the old ones or the really young ones, they come up to where the food is good, which is Astoria. And that's why we'll see those sea lions all the time. Not just the salmon are they after, they're after all the different kinds of fish we have here.
I see. Well, that's fascinating. I had no idea. And so then the California sea lion females deliver their pups down there.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. And down in California. And then, you know, the yearlings, the younger males, and you can just look at the sea lions and tell which ones are young and which ones are old. And the best way, and I did happen to bring a skull in here to show you, I'm just going to kind of hold it up. And those of you, of course, can't see it on the radio. There is a big ridge or a bump on top of the skull. So if you're down looking at the sea lions and it has a big bump on its head, that is an older male. The young males don't get those until they're mature. The old ones are massive.
Massive.
And the younger ones are the kind of small, skinny. You can also tell by the colorations as well. So, you know, the old salts, maybe they look a little bit more beaten up and been through quite a lot.
Okay. And what is the difference between the sea lions and the seals?
That is a wonderful question. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. They're both pinnipeds, which is Latin. It means feather footed. So a couple obvious ways you can tell from afar, the colorations are different. So a seal is kind of spotted and they're tan and they're gray and they're usually pretty small and kind of stout, and they have internal ears, so they won't actually have ear flaps, where sea lions have little teeny exterior ears. The other way you can tell when they're on land is the way that they move about. So sea lions actually walk up on their front flippers and seals scooch on their bellies.
Aww.
And so it's not really a size thing. For example, the largest pinniped is a elephant seal, And they scooch on their bellies.
Wow.
Compared to the sea lions and fur seals, you know, they kind of scooch up
on their little flips,
yep.
on their little flippers, right.
So that's the easiest way to
tell.
Are they
in competition with each other as far as food is concerned?
You know, I'm sure they eat some of the same things. I'm not so aware of if they're, you know, going to battle over the food.
They don't seem to. And do they hang out together? Or are they sort of...
You know, it's interesting. When I was thinking about this last night, I was thinking, when was the last time I saw a harbor seal? And those are the little kind of gray spotted ones.
Yes.
In the river. And I was thinking, you know, I used to see them outside in front of my window all the time, and I haven't been noticing them. I'm sure they're still around in places. The best place to see those is out near the ocean beaches, like on the Columbia River. If you go out to Fort Stevens State Park and go to the Columbia Beach, especially in the springtime, they'll leave their pups up there, which is another thing I would love to chat about, is what to do if you see, which I think is one of the most adorable things in the world, is a little seal pup.
Aww.
All alone on the beach by itself. You know, is it okay? What do you do? Thing to do is to leave it be. The mom leaves the pup there and will go out and feed and then come back. And if the mom is coming back to her pup and sees you, the mom will turn around and leave.
Oh.
If the mom comes back to the pup and the pup smells like something foreign, it has the smell of a human or a dog or anything else, the mom might also be scared away as well. And of course, you know, a pup cannot live without its mom.
Right. And so how long would a little seal pup, for example, be there?
You know, it could be all day long.
Okay.
There was one of the things that will happen is if there is a pup, especially if it's in an area that's highly trafficked, is the Marine Mammal Sanctuary Network will have somebody come out there and pup sit, or basically put up a sign and let people know to stay away and to give room for the mom to come back.
Right.
And also, you know, educate people as well about what's going on.
We have whales here.
Yes.
In this area. So what kind of whales do we have here?
So we have gray whales. Those are the most typical that you will see. Especially in December when they're starting their migration, and also in the spring.
So in the December migration, are they going south?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll be seeing them. How far out? How far away from the shore?
You know, I've actually been out to the North Head Lighthouse, and I have seen gray whales right close to shore there.
Oh, wow.
And so gray whales, you know, they feed. They don't eat the way that you would think most of the whales do with their baleen. They're not catching fish or krill or things like that. What they actually do is they go to the muddy bottom of the ocean and they scoop up a big load of dirt. And then they close their mouth and they have these little hair-like things called baleen that comes down. And they lift their tongue up and they push all of that muddy muck out through, and little crabby creatures get caught in there, and that's what they'll eat. So you'll typically easily see them pretty close to shore.
Wow.
It's also been in the last few years, you know, we've been having, you know, summer resident whales. So, you know, they're migrating up to Alaska where there's tons and tons of food. But when they get up here and if there's plenty of food to support them, well, why keep on swimming, right?
Ah.
So especially down by Depot Bay, all summer you'll see whales. And, you know, even in this area. This summer, what was really incredible were the humpback whales that were around. We went out with the museum out to Tillamook Rock with the seamanship program at Tongue Point. And as we were cruising out over the bar, we got to see humpback whales breaching. And I know all the people in Buoy 10 fishing this year, there was tons of videos that were popping up all over Facebook and the internet from fishermen seeing all these, you know, the whale show as they were going.
Oh, cool. And so the humpback whales, they have teeth, not the baleen.
No, they are.
They also
yes.
have the baleen.
So another way to kind of think about it is there's two categories of whales. There's
okay.
toothed whales.
Right.
And there's baleen whales.
Right.
And so the toothed whales, they have a single blowhole. And a baleen whale has a double blowhole.
Ah. Yeah.
And the largest toothed whale, of course, is the sperm whale. You know, famous for Moby Dick, the
right.
I think gorgeous large head,
yes.
and they have massive teeth. Around here, the toothed whales that we'll see are orcas, you know, and they're out in pods. And, you know, every year they're spotted out and around the mouth of the Columbia River as well.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And we also have fin whales, which you don't see those too often. Have seen one wash up on the beach before. So it's basically the fin whales. You know, there's, of course, blue whales way out there. But speaking what we could see here are humpbacks, gray whales, and, of course, the orca.
Okay. And do we have any dolphin or porpoises or any
of
those?
Yeah, so we have a porpoise, which is what you'll see a lot out here. I actually brought you, this is really interesting. This is a ear bone from a harbor porpoise.
Oh my.
And so you even see those sometimes out in the river, but those are the, you know, creatures that you'll see swimming out the bow of boats and ships like that.
We have sharks in this area?
Oh, absolutely. We have there's 15 different sharks that are found in the Pacific Northwest. And that goes from all the way to the huge, huge basking sharks, all the way down to the tiny little dogfish. But the one everybody wants to know about, of course, is the white shark. And or some people will call it the great white shark. And we have white sharks here. And we also have salmon sharks, which, of course, their favorite food is salmon. So, yeah, we have 15 different types of sharks found in the Pacific.
You're listening to Animal Gab Radio. Now, let's descend down into the water a little bit and just sort of briefly talk about the type of fish that we have in this area.
A lot of rockfish out here. It's, you know, and some of those rockfish can get very, very old.
So, rockfish, you know, because they hang out on rocks?
Yeah, and they're basically bottom fish. So, okay. And there's a lot of different types of rockfish.
Are they flat?
Some of them are. So we have like the soles and the halibut and the flounders.
Okay,
those are all flat fish.
And are they all rockfish? Or
yes.
Really?
They're
I had no
in the
idea
category
that there was
of
a...
the rock.
Yeah, cool.
And we kind of say, you know, the typical term would be ground fish, and that will put in all the flat fish and all of the rock fish. For example, one of the flat fish, one of the most incredible adaptations in nature, is they start out swimming like a normal fish, sort of side to side, one eye on each side of their head. And they actually morph over to swimming on their sides and go flat. And then, of course, nobody needs an eye on the bottom because they're, you know, bottom fish. So the eye literally moves from one side of the head over to the other so that they morph to having two eyes.
Wow, cool.
Head.
So besides the fish that we have other creatures. We have crabs. What other kind of mussels?
Yeah, we have sea stars.
Sea stars, yes. And how are they doing, by the way?
You know, there has been some issues with the sea stars.
Yeah, I know.
And again, I'm not 100% an expert on, you know, what is going on and how the health is, but I have been hearing and reading some things that, you know, there are some things that they're keeping a close watch on.
Yes, well, I know that they were absolutely decimated a few years ago by this wasting disease,
mm-hmm.
and that at one point there was no sea stars at Haystack Rock at all.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. And then they started coming up again, but they would make it till they were juveniles, and then whatever it was would overtake them. And since then, I've seen almost no literature at all, so I'm not sure. I'll look into that as well, because I can't even imagine a world without starfish. I mean, that was one of my favorite things in the world when I was a kid, and I just can't even imagine them being gone. So
yeah, and it really changes the environment. If you know, if we you know talk about sea otters, for example, they're a keystone species, and of course, in this area, we used to have lots and lots of sea otters, and because of different you know human influence things, the sea otters are no longer in this area.
Aww.
Even to the point where in the 1990s, the government transplanted some sea otters here in Oregon and Washington, and the raft of otters that they brought down here just disappeared very shortly.
And
they're not exactly sure what happened.
They don't know what happened.
The population that they transplanted into Washington State did seem to take hold. And depending on the numbers that you look at, there's anywhere between, you know, 300, 500, maybe more sea otters living up in the Olympic National Park area, in that coastline.
So what are their predators? What are the predators?
So sea otters' predators are orcas and sharks.
I see.
And, of course, humans. There was something, you know, I love, you know, children is sort of my jam, right? And I love when kids can do amazing things and can get things changed. And one of my favorite stories is there was a daughter, you know, her father did happen to be in the government and the legislature in California, but she had been doing these projects and figuring out what's happening to our sea otters that are found in California are only found in California. And it was, you know, they were getting caught in gill nets, so they moved the gill net fishermen further offshore, and the numbers were still going down. A side note, this population was thought to have been extinct and was found and by Big Sur in this kind of desolate area where people couldn't get, that's how they were able to survive all of the fur trade. And the numbers were still going down and down. And this young girl found out that it might have something to do with the parasites found in kitty litter. And so people were, you know, cleaning out their litter boxes and putting that stuff in the toilet. And then it would go through the systems and it would get cleaned out at the wastewater treatment facility. And then, of course, that water that is clean is dumped back into our waterways and makes its way into the ocean. Well, the parasites found in that cat feces was infecting the sea otters. The sea otter, where it's a keystone species. So as soon
what does
as,
that mean, keystone?
So that means is if you remove this animal from the environment, that environment is going to change. And so in, you know, in these environments that we have, you know, on land, in the ocean, you know, the sea otter had a particular task. They eat a lot of food. And urchins is one of their favorite foods. And of course, urchins decimate kelp beds. And so, you know, the urchin, the sea otters help keep the urchin population in check. You remove the sea otter from that environment, the urchins go wild, they destroy the kelp bed. So now that there's no kelp beds, there's no nurseries for small fish. There, you know, all of a sudden you remove one animal from that environment and the entire environment can collapse or change. And that's, you know, it's for the health of that environment, you need to keep that balance intact.
Yeah. Aww.
And so she convinced her father, and her father convinced his colleagues to pass a law to make that illegal. Just a small story how, you know, one single child can, you know, change something for a whole species.
Yes. So. And that's something we all need to remember. As an old friend of mine often says, if we each did one thing for the world today, there'd be 7.2 billion things done by tomorrow.
I'm a cuddly lover of cuddly things.
Yes, of course.
And also birds, but from afar. And I love going to Haystack Rock and seeing the birds. And I love the activity. I also love the relationship between predator and prey, where at one moment you're a predator and the next minute you're a prey. And the things that people do to protect their eggs. Not Aww. People, I should say.
Yes, animals.
Birds do to protect their eggs. And, you know, I love the birds that will actually pretend there's an injury. So if you get too close to where their egg is, they'll put on a show as if they're injured. And, of course, any predator sees an injured prey and says, that's easy pickings. I can go and eat that. And so it will lure the predator, and it will do this to people as well. So if you ever see a bird acting kind of like it's got a broken wing, kind of follow where it wants you to go. And they're leading you away. And then once you're far enough away or the predator, they make a move and it says, oh, just kidding, I'm fine.
So tell me just briefly about the seabirds, especially the ones that go under the water. Is it like gannets? Do we have any gannets around?
Yeah. And have you ever seen a video of underwater of those birds?
No.
So there's a great website. It's called Archive. And it's all nature videos, and it's crowdsourced. So I have some videos that I've taken of things that I've uploaded on there and photographs, and they're used for scientific research. And if they're sold for advertisements, then this organization that protects animals gets the money. So you kind of donate your video footage. And there's some amazing video of these birds underwater. And they look like they're flying underwater. They use those wings like little paddles. And it's almost like a ballet underwater with when they're going under. It's quite incredible.
Oh, it sounds it. And so are the, but the seagulls, do seagulls do that as well? Or just?
I haven't seen any videos of the gulls. And the gulls we have around here are the western gulls, which they are all also very intelligent as well. And of course, just a friendly reminder to everyone listening, please refrain from feeding the gulls, and that really goes for any wildlife, and not because you're going to attract more. It's really a safety issue for the birds.
Right.
So if people have you seen them feeding from their cars all the time,
I know.
Then now the gulls associate cars as a source of food.
That's right.
And if you've seen dead gulls on the bridge or in other places, it's because. How would a bird get run over by a car? Well, they're going up there for food. And so it's a safety and a health reason for us and a safety and also a health reason for them.
Yeah, because birds don't eat Cheetos.
No.
Yes, right. And we seem to think, for some reason, that we can feed them this all the stuff that we eat and that that's okay. We have no idea. Yeah, actually, just yesterday I saw a man in his driveway throw out a bunch of, I don't even know what it was. I think it was old bread or something. And the birds all came, the gulls all came down. And I'm sure he thought he was doing them a favor.
Yeah. Just, even with the ducks too, people always think, oh, ducks love bread.
And, yeah, right.
It's not, their bodies aren't built to process that.
No.
Their bodies are built to process the food that they eat in nature.
Yeah.
And also by giving, especially with, waterfowl that we have a lot around, we are on the Pacific Coast Flyway. Are you aware of what the Pacific Coast Flyway is?
No.
I love the name of it. It's like a highway for birds. And so when they're migrating, they, of course, all need rest stops. Like when we're traveling on the highway, we need to make a rest stop. And so they'll come in on their migration patterns to places where it's good for them to take a rest and to find food. And we are right on there. So you hear the geese and the ducks flying over. And if they come and land and then all of a sudden, you got your local little duck and you're feeding it, why would they leave, right? They're getting fed. Right. And next thing the weather turns and they're
dead.
Yeah.
Right. And they've lost their group too.
Yes.
Yes.
And speaking of the Canada goose, they're not Canadian geese. They're not Canadian citizens. It's a Canada goose. One of my favorite sort of things to talk about, they're loyal. And I've been harassed and followed by a goose before. They are not the cuddly, quite aggressive sometimes, but the loyalty they have to each other I find fascinating. So when they are migrating, if in the flock there is a goose who is injured or is tired or for some reason has to descend, it will never go by itself. Other geese will always come with it.
Aww.
And let's say it is so sick and it is dying. Those geese who went with it will not leave that goose alone. They will, to the detriment of themselves sometimes, they will wait until nature takes its course before they continue on. And
aww.
I love, in nature, I love these sort of the loyalty and, the certain animals that mate for life and just...
Well, I do too, because in the research for this program, I started realizing that inevitably the sort of biologic imperative was predator-prey, because food is the first thing, right? And I must admit, in some ways, I thought, oh, is that all it is? But as I began further researching, I discovered that they know that altruism, loyalty, community, and love are also biologic imperative. And without those, you would not have families. You would not have packs. You would not have pods. You would not have groups protecting each other. And there's some strange behavior, within the animal families, just as there are within ours. But that it really reassured me that, yes, that's, dog eat dog is one of the basic rules of life. But so is dog love dog. And that it's just like, okay, well, this is what we need to understand. We can't just say nature is red in tooth and claw and leave it at that, because it isn't. It's also sacrifice. And there are animals that will alert the rest to a predator and then go after the predator so that the rest can get away. I mean, that's sacrifice.
And absolutely.
And there's something beyond that. I mean, that's a decision. That's an intention. That's not just, you know, necessarily just, I don't think we can just basically call that an instinct, because it takes courage.
Absolutely. And if you think about like a rookery, for example, you know, they're all individual families, but they're working together for the greater cause. So everybody needs to rest. And if a predator is around, you know, they all start alerting each other. And, you know, for me, one of the fascinating, you know, we were talking about the predator-prey relationship, and I feel it's nature at its most primitive and primal and just, you know, been happening for millions of years. And if you just go out to some of the cliff sides or Haystack Rock and you see these, you know, the gulls they're nasty dudes. You know, they will steal your eggs. And, you know, there are birds whose sole survival is stealing other people's eggs. And just seeing them kind of hovering around and, you know, without that protection, it just really makes you feel how lucky we are to have a home and have somewhere safe where you don't have to be on guard for your survival.
Absolutely. There are parts of the world where that cannot be said.
Absolutely.
And we are very fortunate here. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, well, thank you.
Yeah, this was exciting.
You have been listening to Animal Gab Radio, produced by Asa Cody. To hear it again, check out our podcast by visiting the Animal Gab Radio page at coastradio.org. There you'll find a link to our website for more information about the Columbia River Maritime Museum and the Archive Nature video site, along with photos of Nate's show and tell. Our next talk with a tale is Oceana Part 2, featuring interviews with the Marine Stranding Network at the Seaside Aquarium and Lynn Buckmaster, ocean environmentalist specializing in plastic pollution. One of the most wonderful facts that Nate shared with me is that sea otters have evolved a little pocket under their armpit where they keep their tools. How can we fail to be impressed by that? It clearly demonstrates a species capable of self-awareness, ingenuity, intention, even artistry. If animals are capable of art, they are far superior than our short-sighted, mechanistic view has us believe. They are deserving of respect, admiration, protection, and awe. Listen, this is a song of freedom.